Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome, everyone. We're about to have a conversation about Syria. On the way there, I want to tell you and remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its community and its members prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. www.mecu.com. Remember, it is a credit union, not just a bank, so it belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. www.mecu.com. You can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner as well. mecu.com, Baltimore's credit union. All right, so we are gathering a panel. Our guests have been here before. We brought them back to wrestle with this issue that has been in the headlines, in the news, affecting the entire world. We are joined in studio by Dr. Adil Shamu, professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and in Policy in Focus, where he's a contributing writer. Dr. Tabat Abdullah, professor of history at York University in Toronto. John Rosenthal, who writes on European politics and transatlantic security issues and has been covering Syria for the National Review. And Adil, Tabat, John, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you for having me.
You can all join us here at 410-319-8888. And Tabat and John, welcome. Good to have you with us as well. You have them potted up?
Yes, I hear you fine.
Hi, Tabat. Welcome. Good to have you all here. So this is, and folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. We've seen the last couple of days that Riyad Hijab, the former foreign minister, defected. Though, as many have written in the press, he's not part of the inner circle around Bashar Assad. He was a powerful figure in the government, and people look at his leaving Syria as significant. But let's talk about the complexity of this. And Tabat, then we'll go to Adil and John Rosenthal. We have a tendency, Tabat, to kind of look at Syria as Assad, this evil dictator, oppressing his people, and it needs to be overthrown, and we all support, everybody in the press supports the rebels in the Syrian Free Army. But life is more complex than that. I mean, while Assad may in fact be a brutal, vicious dictator, it's not that simple.
No, of course, nothing ever is. The situation in Syria, I think, for many, many decades, Syria, like Iraq, has always had an underlying current of opposition, people grumbling because of the very oppressive nature of the government. But this has been kept, the lid has been kept on it through the use of force, but also because these regimes have actually delivered some services, running water, increasing electrification of the countryside, more an expansion of education, opportunities, etc. But really, in the 80s and the 90s, these services were drastically cut back. And added with that some of the natural disasters, the drought that has affected Syria for several years, have all sort of brought to the fore the issue of, well, if these regimes are despised because of their undemocratic natures, because of their perceived sectarian base of support, and on top of that, their lack of producing any kind of services, this, of course, all then comes to a head and results in an explosion. But the big problem in Syria, as opposed to some of the other places that we've witnessed with respect to the Arab Spring, is the fact that with the implosion of the Syrian regime, the country seems to be headed more and more toward a Lebanon-like situation, whereby the regime doesn't completely fall. It becomes more and more isolated in terms of a sectarian base of support, and the opposition is also rather fragmented. And this could go on and on for many, many, many years. And I'm not so sure, really, that the forces opposing Assad are all that good either. I mean, there's a very strong tinge of rather even neo-fascistic elements.
Adil, when you wrote your piece on this for Huffington Post and In Focus, one of the things you talk about is that in, you know, we, again, going back to what's going on, and it may shock a number of people who don't follow it as closely, that the Christian community, the Alawite community, other communities in Syria are more behind Assad than they are what we call the freedom fighters.
I think so. What Thabit was talking about the mosaic structure of Syria, you have Sunni and Shia, these are the two major religion. You have the Alawite, which are a sect of the Shiite. You have the Christians. They have the middle class and upper middle class, the business, the traders, etc. So not everybody is in the opposition because they were protected by the Syrian regime. The Christians felt safe, the wealthy felt safe, and the middle class felt safe. So once you take that protection, what is next? And the opposition hasn't done a good job to emphasize and bring together the diverse group, just like really in Iraq. They never were able to bring all sides to the table in opposition to Saddam. That's why Saddam lasted so long. So no one knows what will happen. Unfortunately, in especially U.S. media, there is like a drumbeat, just like the way they did it with Saddam. Just because you have someone who committed crimes against humanity, which is Assad, toppling them does not mean there is going to be Garden of Eden after that. There could be worse. Iraq was a good example that it was worse than Saddam. He killed many, but not 200,000-300,000 deaths occurred during his reign. So that is really the issue we need to look into and be careful. What is next? And unfortunately, some of the superpower and strong Western countries, they were not interested in peaceful resolution because within a couple of weeks, everybody said, Assad must go. Well, that's a regime change, basically. Assad will go. Who's going to replace them? And the opposition was in disarray at that time. At least now they're a little more organized.
John Rosenthal.
Yeah, the only thing I'd add to that is that, of course, the Syrian government forces and Bashar al-Assad have been accused right from the start of crimes against humanity. But there's no question at this point that the Free Syrian Army or the very diverse groups which compose the Free Syrian Army, which include brigades that identify themselves as Islamic extremist brigades, jihadist brigades. In fact, a large part of the Free Syrian Army identifies itself as such. They are also committing, or they are in any case definitely committing, war crimes and crimes against humanity. A couple of weeks ago, there was a German reporter for the Frankfurt Allgemeine Zeitung, which is the most influential paper in Germany, it's like the equivalent of the New York Times in Germany, who visited two villages to the north of Aleppo. So the area to the north of Aleppo towards the Turkish border is largely controlled, maybe at this point completely controlled, by the Free Syrian Army. And what he found is that you had, in villages that were controlled by the Free Syrian Army, you had civilians being rounded up, detained arbitrarily, sometimes just on the basis, for example, of religion. So you had Alawites being treated as a priori suspect by the new authorities in the area and being rounded up and detained. There was evidence of torture, again, not just torture of government soldiers, but torture, it would seem, of civilians. And you had examples of government soldiers being taken prisoner and then being summarily executed. So if it's an issue of war crimes and crimes against humanity, again, it's not sure which side you would choose in this case. You have very, very clear evidence that the rebels, who we and the entirety of the European Union are supporting, are themselves guilty of really atrocious crimes.
So,
Sorry,
go ahead, Thabit, please, go ahead.
Sorry, I just want to clarify a little bit my position on this. I agree with everything that's been said concerning our caution as to who this opposition is. But it's also important to underline the fact that much of the even the nature of the opposition to this regime is the result of the really heinous nature of the regime itself. I mean, when the uprisings first began last year, over a year ago, there were many instances, actually, of Christians and of Alawis joining the opposition's demonstrations. For example, Ladakhiya, which is really the most important city in the Alawi region of Syria. Ladakhiya witnessed some of the most impressive demonstrations against the regime. Several of the leaders initially of the especially when during prior to the violent wave that began to engulf the Syria, at the time when it was in the form of demonstrations, several of the leaders were also of the Christian elements in Syria. But the regime itself played the sectarian card, and this is exactly what happened in Iraq, a country that I know better. But still, there's a lot of similarities. When these regimes are challenged, they fall back on the sectarian card. And the way that the Assad regime responded to these demonstrations, especially in Ladakhiya, was to unleash the thugs, the so-called Shabiha, who were of of Alawi background, but in fact of the tribal elements that the Assad family comes from, to unleash them and to unfurl sectarian banners, actually. Also, the regime has played the sectarian card in terms of its propaganda by constantly referring to the opposition as being Islamist and jihadist and so forth, even when some of the leaders clearly aren't. So I am extremely wary of where Syria is going. In fact, I am much more optimistic about Iraq than I am about Syria.
That's interesting.
But much of the sectarianism is the work of these Hayyanist regimes themselves.
Oh, go ahead, Adil, then I'll go back.
Well, I think that there are forces bigger than Syria operating in Middle East, and I think that's the direction it's taking in Syria. I think the West and the United States and Russia, they are playing not a healthy role in Middle East, because I think it will be in our interest, in the United States, our interest to have a weak Syria and a regime who is compliant to our wishes and the Western wishes, so we'll have continued peace with Israel, will not be doing any trouble in Iraq or in Jordan, and would be friendly to Egypt. So we can, to me, is if there is a grand plan, the grand plan is you have Israel and our friends to be the superpowers in Middle East, supported by tens of billions of dollars of the Saudi money. Remember, the Saudi money has played a dirty role in Syria as well as dirty role in Iraq. They are spending hundreds of millions of dollars supporting the suicide bombers and the Sunni opposition to whatever regime they didn't like. It was Shiite, for example. So those are the type of forces, the strategic forces in the Middle East are working to the detriment of the Syrians, and they were detriment to the Iraqi.
So, John, I'm curious to say, when you heard what both Tabet Abdullah and Adil Shamu were saying, I mean, how do you?
I should just mention one of your other guests. I'm not hearing very well. I'm sorry about that. But I think the guest who's in the studio, I'm hearing fine. The other guest, I'm not hearing well at all.
We will work on that. Sorry about that.
Okay.
No problem. No, that's all right. Because I think one of the things that Tabet was saying earlier that I was going to ask you to comment on was the idea that sometimes we are, and not to put words in your mouth, Tabet, but that we're vilifying in some senses the anti-Assad forces as being al-Qaeda and fundamentalists, when there are a number of places in Syria where...
Self-identified as such. Not all of them,
of course.
I can't
hear anything all of a sudden.
But, you know, by now there are... dozens, or at least they're in a lot of videos of rebel brigades, which themselves, pose with the al-Qaeda flag. Sometimes you hear people saying, a recent article in the New York Times, they said, oh, no, this is the flag of Muhammad. There's a tradition of the so-called caliphate flag, which is just a black flag with the Shahada, the Islamic Declaration of Faith, written on it. But there's a more specific black flag, which has a white circle in the middle, and also has the Shahada written on it in white and black. And that, I mean, maybe your other guests know of earlier uses of it, but certainly it was made famous, not by Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda, but more specifically by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and al-Qaeda in Iraq. And actually, even by al-Qaeda standards, al-Qaeda in Iraq was particularly brutal. So that flag became known from all the videos that al-Qaeda in Iraq produced and distributed, showing beheadings of American and British hostages and showing summary executions of Iraqi security personnel. When groups pose with that same flag, the message is absolutely unambiguous. It's a message of identification with the jihadist ideology of al-Qaeda. And by now, there are many, many, many videos of these groups posing with this flag. And apart from the appearance of the al-Qaeda flag, there's also just the methods which are being used in the conflict. Now, the methods of al-Assad, naturally, have been condemned by all the world, all the NGOs, all the Western powers. But the methods being used by, I would even say, the most effective part of the rebellion are, unfortunately, obviously terrorist methods and obviously the methods that were, so to speak, pioneered by al-Qaeda. They are, for instance, suicide bombings. Suicide bombings is the signature form of attack, as, for instance, Moussaoui, the so-called, Zakarias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, said in his trial, what we do is suicide bombings. According to the German Foreign Intelligence Service, the BND, there have been 90 suicide attacks in Syria between the beginning of January and the end of July, and the beginning of July. In the meanwhile, there have been several more. So again, if you put together the declarations of some of the groups composing the Free Syrian Army itself, you put that together with the methods which are being used on the ground, which are suicide bombings. There are videos which recently appeared, apparently, or at least got publicity in the States and in Europe, of, again, beheadings, of summary executions, of postal workers, apparently, being thrown out of windows. Actually, these videos have been around for a while. They're not new, but they're getting attention just now. You've had different groups associated with the Free Syrian Army capturing journalists. Okay, they're journalists that work maybe for the state television or work for broadcasters, right, which are pro-regime. But I would think in the West, we would generally, even if we don't happen to like that media, we don't support, I hope we don't support, kidnapping and executing journalists. And that is what is happening today in Syria.
So, Tabit, were you able to hear our other guest?
Yes, I heard only half of what he said, I'm afraid, and this is a bit of a problem because I think I was misunderstood. What I said was that the extremist nature of the opposition to the Assad regime, to a great extent, is the work of the regime itself, that it played the sectarian card, that it inflamed the sectarian feelings in the country as a sort of last-ditch effort to save itself. I was not in any way condoning these extremist
methods. Right, of course. I understood that. And to be perfectly honest, I understand your analysis. Yeah. I don't know if I agree with it 100% because, as your other guest mentioned, there are foreign influences, also regional powers like Qatar and Saudi Arabia, which are very involved in the conflict.
Let me let Tabit finish his thought.
They also,
I'm sorry, John.
Sorry. No, I don't disagree with any of this. Some of the disagreements, quote unquote, that we might have is only a result of the fact that we're making these kind of short comments on a very, very complicated situation. So yes, of course. But when we were going through our initial statement and discussing the dangers of the extremist opposition to the regime, I wanted to underline what I thought was something that sometimes gets neglected, and that is that to a great extent, it is some of this is the responsibility of the regime itself. But it seems to me that one needs to go beyond this now. I mean, the the Arab Spring has brought about people into the streets. There's no way that this movement is going to be rolled back. People will look for leadership when the time comes for revolutionary change. And for many decades now, these regimes, like the Assad regime, like Saddam's regime in Iraq, have crushed every semblance of civil society or independent political organization. The only thing that's left is the religious expression, and this is what is providing the terminology, the vision, the leadership for the Arab Spring. I personally don't think it will last very long, the control of the extremists, because they really can't deliver on anything except violence. But still, they are a huge danger.
I just want to make a distinction. I believe the Muslim Brotherhood, especially the branches in Egypt and some other places, are not in that group. I don't consider them in that group. I think they have shown for nearly 50 years very responsible behavior, even toward Mubarak. They never used suicide bombing and violence in achieving their goal, and they won the election free, as everyone has testified. So I don't put the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and few other places in the same category, really, of Al-Qaeda or some extremist Muslims groups like the jihadists.
Right. But that only underscores that at least some of the groups that are especially active in Syria right now really are the most extreme currents within the so-called Muslim world or the Arab world.
Yeah, a reporter from the Lebanese newspaper Al Hayat recently joined some of the groups in Syria, some of the opposition groups, and in his article, which is based only on observation, not a scientific survey, he estimates that the most extremist elements constitute about 20% of the armed militias, which is huge, actually, very large.
Yes, it is very large.
And he also said that they were the best organized, best funded, and best equipped of all the groups.
So I want to ask, there's a couple of questions I want to get to here that I think we have to get to. One of them has to do with the foreign influence, all this, whether it's the American influence, Russian, Israeli, Iranian, all the things that are playing into this. We'll come to that. But I want to take a step back for just a moment. And John, I'd like you to comment when you hear this as well. But it's actually really directed at this point to Adil Shamu and Talbot Abdullah. Both of you grew up in the Middle East. You're both Iraqis. And I know, Talbot, you spent time in Syria.
Yes.
Living.
I lived there for a year.
For when you were in the beginning of your exile from Iraq. And both of you come from the non-Muslim world,
right,
inside of your country.
Yes.
And a lot of this, you know, we're seeing articles come out, like in the Wall Street Journal just a few days ago over the weekend, an interesting article about, is this the death of Christianity in Syria, was one of the lead articles in the Wall Street Review this Saturday. And so I'm curious, as two men who are both Arabs, who are not Muslim, what this says, it portends about the future of the Arab world and where this might take it, because you're seeing changes in the Arab world in the last 60 years. That was a world that was clearly mostly Muslim, whether it was Shia or Sunni, but has significant Jewish and Christian populations, and that world's changing. In that sense, and also changing politically. So I'm just curious, as two men who come from that world, how you see this transition and what do you think is happening? Adil, then Talbot.
I think, unfortunately, it's going to the worst for the Christians in Iraq and probably in Syria too. And the reasons are complex, okay? And because these elements we're talking about, the Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda-like mentality and the suicide bombers, they wanted to generate the sectarian violence. So killing, you know, a Shiite is fine, but really killing Christian, that's even better for the sectarian strife.
Uh-huh.
So the Christians are afraid for their life. I think 50% of Christians in Iraq have disappeared since 9/11 from Iraq. They have fled the country. And I wouldn't be surprised in another year or two if Syria remained that way. The same thing will happen there. Right. Because they're very vulnerable.
Unfortunately, I understood many.
I have to just jump in. We have to get a very quick break, and we'll come right back to Talbot Abdullah, then hear John Rosenthal, and come back to our larger question about how the international forces play in this and why it's so key to all these international regimes. Stay with us. We'll be right back as we continue our conversation about Syria. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On our way back to our conversation, I want to remind you to join us August the 23rd from 7:30 to 9:30 a.m. At the James E. Lewis Museum of Art. We are having our annual community entertainment for WEAA, and you can find out how your nonprofit organization can take part of this and take advantage of this radio station. It's your chance to meet hosts, producers, learn about Community Cares Program, PSA submission requirements, media partnerships, and much more. There's no cost, but space is limited, and we'd like you to join us. Call Sandy Mallory at 443-885-4531. That's 443-885-4531. We are here with Dr. Adil Shamu, Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and a contributor to Policy and Focus at the IPS. Dr. Talbot Abdullah, professor of history at York University, John Rosenthal, who writes on European politics and transatlantic security issues, and been covering Syria, for the National Review. 410-319-8888 is our number. Talbot, let me turn to you now. And one of the things that Dil said during the break that I'll just share, and I've heard this from many people, especially Baghdadis and many people from Iraq, that the end of diversity inside the Arab world, people tear up, and it becomes a very emotional issue as well. But go ahead, Talbot.
Yes, this is an extremely painful subject, of course. I belong to an even tinier minority than that of Dr. Shammo. My community is known as the Mandaeans, probably the last link to ancient Mesopotamia that exists in Iraq, a pre-Christian and very ancient religion. But it's a terrible, terrible price that the region is paying to begin to investigate the possibility of a transition to democracy. Oddly enough, I am still optimistic in the long run that this series of uprisings will eventually produce greater representative governments, not necessarily full-fledged democracies, but greater representation, that it will produce a bit more transparency. And it is, in my opinion, a step forward. But there is a terrible price that is being paid. Revolutions are extremely messy affairs. Anybody that has studied European history is very well acquainted with this, and the attack against the religious minorities will delay the transition to democracy for sure, because minorities have always been a force that has promoted citizenship, that has promoted representative governments, etc. They've always lobbied for this, and the whole issue of identity that is very much now part of analysis, and so everybody's looking for what is this group's identity, what's that group's identity. Identities are extremely fluid things. For example, I know that the Christians and the Mandaeans and the Jews, even in Iraq in the 30s and 40s, when the whole issue of what kind of identity should we embrace, they all embraced Arabism, and everybody started saying we're all Arabs because it's something that is inclusive. This new wave of Islamic politics that is leading the political discourse in the Middle East does not allow these religious groups to belong. and it's extremely dangerous. I believe that it won't last. I think it will burn itself out, but the price will be quite high before it does.
Now, John, I know you're neither Arab nor Christian nor Mandean, but if you wanted to chime in, we'd love to hear your thoughts.
No, I was just going to add, absolutely, I need to defer to your other guests on this question. But and besides that, I'm not even a Middle East specialist. I'm a European politics specialist and transatlantic issues specialist. But one of the real tragedies, it seems to me, of what's going on in Syria, and your other guests can correct me on this if I'm wrong, but as I've understood it, many Christians who fled Iraq fled precisely to Syria.
That's correct.
And
yeah,
where
a lot
do they go
of them.
Now? Because it's as if... Excuse me?
You're right. I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah, that's what I understood. And now you have, it's as if Al-Qaeda is basically following them from one country to another, and where do they go? Some are maybe going back to Iraq, but now they're going to be made refugees yet again. So it is a huge, huge tragedy. And I've been somewhat amazed, and I'm based in Europe, so maybe my impressions of what's going on in the American media are not 100% accurate, but it seems like that story of what's happening to the Christian populations, as well as other religious minority populations in Syria, really has not been getting over to a broader public. And I've had contact with Christians in Syria, some of whom have actually denounced very forcefully the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, and they just aren't being heard. And I know even if I want to place articles, if I want to do an interview, for instance, with some of these people who are at monasteries in Syria, and I assume for many Arab countries it would be even unusual that you have monasteries which are still being preserved and maintained and are active, to even try to, say, do an interview with one of these monks who is at a monastery in Syria, is there any part of the American media out there that would be interested in it? For me, as a journalist reporting on this sort of stuff, it's not obvious. And that itself strikes me as unfortunate, because it means that the American public is not getting a balanced picture of what's going on.
Do you want to say something?
Just to add a little personal observation on this, when I was living in Syria, in the Christian neighborhood, there was a single Jewish family left. And I often, wonder what's happened to this guy. His name was Murad. And I called some friends, and they said that he and his family have disappeared, and no one knows. But the last Jewish family in the Christian neighborhood of Damascus has disappeared as a result of these events.
You were about to say something, Adil, as well.
Yes,
so, and I think that this was, I wanted to go to this here for a while because I thought it's important, because just in terms of the Middle East being in flux, the Arab world is a very complex place. And again, as we do with Syria and everything else, we make things very simplistic when they're not. And what's not simplistic as well is the foreign interest in all of this, with United States and Europe and Russia and Iran and Israel. Adil, the senior analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus, let you lead off, and then we'll go around the room.
Well, this is why, for example, you're talking about the American media. Saudi Arabia is strong ally.
I left them out. I should not have.
Yeah, Saudi Arabia is a strong ally. Qatar is a strong ally. The whole Gulf states are strong allies. We have 15,000 troops right there, and we have many, many thousands more in ships surrounding this area. Why no coverage here? The State Department hasn't made one single comment about Saudi Arabia sending tens of millions of dollars to suicide bombers and the like. In Iraq and in Syria, by the way, both promoting this sectarian violence. Why our administration hasn't said anything about it? We worry about Assad, crime against humanity. Yes, he's a thug, okay? But to me, that is behavior is thuggery. When you're going to give tens of millions of dollars to suicide bombers and the like in Iraq and in Syria, and destroying the country, basically. Is that serves our U.S. interest? I'm sorry?
I was just saying that we had the same sort of pattern as well in Libya, at least as concerns Qatar.
But this is worse, really, than Libya. Libya sort of was solved sort of much more quickly. This has been going on a year and a half, and it's going to continue. And the American media all the time tells you that, and the State Department gives that impression also, that the regime is going to collapse tomorrow. Every day you get up and think, now that the prime minister have moved to Jordan and said the Syrian regime is crumbling, everybody thinks it's going to crumble. I personally think whether Assad exists or not, the conflict and the bloody civil war will continue in Syria.
So the question, I mean, and we go to the phones here, 410-319-8888, some folks are calling in, but I'm curious what you all think, Talbot Abdullah and then to John Rosenthal. What is in the American interest here in Syria? Do you see what we're being involved in? How is it countered by Russia? How is it countered by Iran?
Okay. First of all, it seems to me that the American interest in Syria is American policy in Syria is dictated by two things. Oil, number one, the huge elephant in the room, I think, that everybody can see, and the strategic alliance with Israel, that security for Israel. These are the two most important elements for American policy in the Middle East. More recently, the policy of the United States has been dictated by its goal of trying to hem in Iranian influence, and that's where Syria comes in. Syria is a strong ally of Iran. It is a base for the projection of Iranian influence, especially into Lebanon, and hence the destruction of the Assad regime will be a blow to Iran, a blow to Hezbollah in Lebanon, and this presumably will serve American interest in the region. What is really dangerous in the way that the Americans are playing this very dangerous game is what Professor Shammu mentioned concerning Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Now, Qatar is a tiny, tiny state. It had never had any kind of influence before. All of a sudden, only in the past couple of years, has it suddenly emerged on the scene full force, and now it's hosting, you know, big tournaments and throwing its weight about in the region as if it is a major regional power. I, for one, it's very difficult for me to believe that all of these pronouncements of Qatar and the Al Jazeera satellite channel, which is based in Qatar, is something that is done without at least some kind of a green light from the United States, which has its primary naval base in the Persian Gulf in Qatar. It has a huge influence on the Qatari regime. And we see these two countries, Qatar and Saudi Arabia, supporting the most backward, the most dangerous elements of this upheaval. And this, to me, is a very odd way that the United States is conducting its policy.
But Saudi Arabia still supports the worst elements in Iraq.
Yes, absolutely.
So John, I'm curious as your take on this.
You asked about the role, for instance, of Russia. One could add China as well. To use maybe a little bit of a provocative formulation, I'm hoping that maybe Russia and China will save us, that is the United States, from ourselves. I don't really see the collapse of the Assad regime as being necessarily in the interest of the United States, nor for that matter in the interest of Israel. Obviously, the Syrian regime was quite anti-Israeli. It hosted the political leadership of Hamas. But there was a kind of status quo in the region, and if that status quo gets disrupted and replaced by either just pure chaos, in which al-Qaeda can flourish, or even Islamist states, which is the aim of a lot of these movements. And again, we've seen that people recently saying, oh, the elections in Libya would have given a great outcome because we have a liberal party, quote-unquote liberal party, which won the elections. Actually, it's not so clear that they won the elections. But in any case, the forces which were militarily allied against Gaddafi were, as well in that case, extremely Islamist, extremely anti-Israeli. So I just can't see how it could be in American interest for 10 years to wage a so-called war on terror, which is a war essentially on al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda-affiliated groups, and then we turn around one day and say it's in our interest to be allied with al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda-affiliated groups. It just doesn't make sense to me. So I wonder if we don't need to analyze this in terms of not sort of a long-term American interest, but rather radical changes in American foreign policy that have happened under the Obama administration. And that in some ways, I think there's another actor who we haven't mentioned, and that's the European Union. And in both the Libyan case and the Syrian case, it was actually the European Union which very early on said, our policy is regime change, for whatever reasons. And I think the American administration somewhat aligned its policies on the policies of the EU. And the EU also has very strong relations with Qatar, not just the United States.
Well, as you know, EU depends on oil more than we do, as a matter of fact. So, of course, eventually everything that happens to them will happen to us.
I think
it's
EU interest than about American interests.
I'm sorry?
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that what's going on in general in the region, to the degree that there are foreign interventions, has much more to do with the EU's perceived interests or the major European powers' perceived interests, that being France, essentially France, Germany, and Great Britain, than it does with American interests. I think to some ways NATO has become kind of a straitjacket for the United States, and we've become the military power of or the military arm of the European Union in trying to force through outcomes which, for, again, whatever reasons, European powers see as being their interest.
But unfortunately...
I do think that there is a logic to American American position on Syria. One, it is to hit at Iranian influence in the region, and this will certainly do that.
Right.
Secondly, though, I think the Americans have looked at this wave of uprisings that began in Tunisia, spread throughout the Arab world, and come to the conclusion that there's no way to turn this back. There's no way that one can go back to the status quo. And hence, the best policy of the United States that would serve its interest is to support change and thus try to establish good relations with the new powers that will emerge. And I think that does make sense. What to me doesn't make sense is how the United States can remain silent when Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and other regional allies of the United States support the most despicable, the most backward, the most terroristic elements of the Arab Spring uprising. Because there are actually very progressive peoples in these uprisings, including Syria. I mean, the way our discussion has gone, it's as if the entire uprising against the Assad regime is composed of nothing but Al Qaeda groups.
Right. No, that's not true. Especially in the first 6 months, a lot of liberal groups were supporting the uprising against Assad, and they sacrificed a great deal. It's really afterwards they couldn't get any kind of agreement and consensus among them.
Yes,
and it got taken away.
But I think a lot of those liberal.
Go ahead, Talbot.
I think also a lot of those more liberal groups don't necessarily support the FSA either, especially now. Especially now that the FSA has resorted to more obviously, say, terroristic methods. And they don't support necessarily either the Syrian National Council. So I think it's absolutely right that within the Syrian opposition to Bashar al-Assad, there are more liberal and more progressive tendencies. But I think it's at least a serious question whether those more liberal, more progressive tendencies are represented on the one hand by the armed forces on the ground. I think they're not.
They're not. You're
right.
I think
the armed forces on the ground are, and even whether they're represented by the Syrian National Council, I suspect that they're not.
And Talbot, I don't think you'd finish your thought. Go ahead.
No. I just wanted to bring into focus the question of the United States, and I mentioned, I finished my thought on what I thought American interests were on that. My big question is, why do the Americans remain silent on the question of how their regional allies are behaving in the area, especially Qatar and Saudi Arabia? I mean, very recently, only a week ago, there was a huge wave of demonstrations in the eastern part of Saudi Arabia, the Shi'i. Mm-hmm. The centers of Saudi Arabia, and the media here said nothing about it. And actually, they raised very similar slogans and chants to the other that are similar to the pattern of other areas of the Arab Spring. The huge waves of protests that took place in Bahrain again did not garner the same kind of strong support on the part of the United States that other countries have. So this to me is questionable in terms of what the United States wants to do in the area.
I have an element, Thabit, to interject here, and that is, I think the U.S. policy in Middle East is contradictory. And their interest is contradictory. That's why their policy is contradictory. I think you're right. Once the Arab Spring happened, and they would rather be friendly to the new governments and the movement. But nevertheless, those new governments threaten U.S. interests, especially when it comes to Israel and Jordan, for example, and Saudis even. So that is the contradiction they are in, and they have not been able really to resolve it.
And I think this is interesting, what you're talking about, Thabit, of Saudi Arabia, just to throw this fact out that people don't realize, is that in the Shia is a fairly large minority in Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
And they're actually based primarily in the oil producing.
Exactly. That's what
right.
I was about to say.
In the east part.
And where the oil is being pumped is a Shia-dominated area.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of factors here.
Near Bahrain.
Right, near Bahrain, which is a majority Shia
yeah, that's
community.
Right.
So all these kind of things, factors, interesting. Also, there's a human factor here in Syria that we don't talk about a great deal. I mean, up to 20,000 people have lost their lives.
That's correct.
Already in Syria. 10% of the population, 1.5 million people are displaced in Syria. 150,000 more in surrounding countries are displaced. I think they said that the UN was talking about there are 37,000 people roughly in Lebanon. There's refugees in Turkey. This is where Hezbollah and other parts of the Palestinian community and the Palestinian community, I should say, also had some sway and power, protection under Assad.
That's right.
That's all in flux. So this really does have a great deal. I mean, what comes out of Syria could affect the entire region.
I think there is a danger there will be conflagration in Middle East if things are not taken care of appropriately.
Right. I think
one of the conclusions that I think decades of unrest in the Middle East have taught me anyway is that it never leads to the doomsday scenario of the entire Middle East sort of falling apart. I think it is quite possible that this could be contained within Syria, and unfortunately it could continue to boil in its own stew and become sort of another Lebanon, which is even a more horrific scenario to ponder.
It is. Let's see if we can get a couple calls. People have called in. They're writing in comments, but let's get a thought here on the air. Michael, you're on the air.
Mark?
Yes.
You'd be interested to know that all that's happening in the Middle East is prophesied. In fact, what's happening in Syria goes like this, that when the Rajbi was Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, was in the cave with his son for 13 years, an angel came to him and said, this is the sign that redemption is imminent. When you see the fall of the king of the east in Damascus, the eastern kingdom will fall, and then the Jews will experience salvation, and Mashiach ben David will arrive, and the Jews will ascend in Jerusalem and enjoy it, as it says in Psalms 37:11, but the humble will inherit the land and delight themselves with the abundant peace. May God have mercy on us and send us a Redeemer speedily in our days. all the things that are happening are in the book of Daniel. We're seeing the prophecies unfold before our eyes. You have the Middle East in upheaval. For example, you have Egypt, you have Tunisia, you have Lebanon, you have Libya.
Right.
All of those things are supposed to happen, and it's a sign that we're in the end times right now. So we have to, when do you
think, all right, Mike, thank you very much.
Going to fall in the East?
Appreciate you being part of the show. 410-319-8880. I come to these other callers as well. And I think part of what we see in the Middle East also is that the dangers of all fundamentalist minds get to work. Go ahead.
May I just briefly comment? You know, this what I just heard is terrifying, you know, because there are these things can become self-fulfilling prophecies. I mean, people believe in all kinds of religious superstitions. I mean, I'm not religious at all, and I view this as basically superstition. But people who believe in them so strongly will do everything they can to make them come about, you know, or to justify them in the form of this. And in America itself, after living there for several years, and I don't live there anymore, but after living there for several years, there is this incredibly strong belief in the end of times and the coming of a savior and so forth, and that the Middle East will be the home for it. And in a convoluted way, it has even affected American policy. And this, to me, is even more terrifying in some ways than the loony extremists in the Middle East.
410-319-8888, and I agree completely. William, you're on the air.
Yeah, the comment I like to make is that, you know, all this is really about Israel, and we all know it. We don't hear a word coming from the media concerning what Israel is doing to the Palestinians, how they're taking Palestinians' homes, how they're taking Palestinian lands, how they're starving the Palestinians out. This radio station is black. Comes out of a black African-American university. And I don't hear anything about Africa on your show.
Well, then you don't listen
enough.
It's
all about Israel. It's all about, you know.
Well, William, I would suggest that you don't listen to the show enough if you think we don't cover Africa or we don't cover African issues. And we cover all the time. I mean, the next segment we're talking about right after the show is over, this segment is we're going to be covering the Middle Passage and the importance of Maryland in the Middle Passage and how we have to address that, and we do cover it all the time. And when we do cover the Middle East and we do cover Israel, there's never a show that we cover about Israel or the Middle East where there's not a Palestinian voice in preponderance on the show. So we cover that all the time. And so I think we are covering issues that come out of Africa and South Africa, as we did yesterday, that nobody else is covering. So I think that we're always covering African issues because they're critical to the future. I mean, one of the things we are going to be covering very soon is the American policy in Africa, the numbers of troops we have in Africa that we don't talk about, those things that are going on as well. So we'll continue to cover those. I want to thank all of our guests for being here today. Dr. Adil Shamu, who is Associate Fellow of the Institute of Policy Studies, Senior Analyst with the Foreign Policy and Focus, Dr. Tabit Abdullah, a professor of history at York University in Toronto, John Rosenthal, covering Syria for the National Review. Appreciate the three of you taking our time with the listeners today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all so much for being with us. We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, we are going to talk about the Middle Passage. An interesting piece is coming to Baltimore about that. We're going to learn a great deal in the next part of our show with Ann Chin, Lou Fields, and Dr. Angela Leonard. So please stay with us.